I'd like to call our attention this morning for our lesson to the sixth chapter of Isaiah, and I'm reading the first eight verses. Familiar, I think, to most of you. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the post of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphims unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. And he laid it upon my mouth and said, Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin purged. And also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I. Send me. I want to call your attention this morning for these moments to the first verse of that reading for our text. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. The fortunes of Israel, as you well remember from your Bible studies, at the period of this historic writing, were rather up and down, almost as a window shade. Good fortune came as good leaders ascended the throne, and as wicked men would come who would destroy the temple of God and the worship of God, the nation would not prosper. It really isn't any different, for righteousness exalteth a nation, and sin is always a reproach to any people. But in this time, Isaiah came to the prophetic office. This does not record his conversion. He had already entered into the office of the prophet and had already given certain directions to Israel which could have come only through divine revelation. But one morning a courier went out of the palace and the untimely announcement was made, the king has died. Isaiah felt, I believe from his writings hitherto, that some reform was going to come to Israel because King Uzziah gave promise of being a good king. His untimely passing threw all of Isaiah's prophecies out of focus. And he said, when I heard the news, I went to the temple. He really went to the only place that a man can really go when deep sorrow troubles his soul. I'm glad this morning that we still have the church. It's human, it has lots of faults, but thank God for it's a refuge from the storm. When life gets rough and things go bad, and my plans fail, I have the fellowship of God's people and his church. This is where Isaiah went. He went in the temple. He had been in the temple many times. He was not unfamiliar with it. But as he entered the temple that day, in deep sorrow for the passing of the king, a new experience came to him. He says, I saw the Lord. But you would imagine that a person of Isaiah's status would have seen the Lord many times before, and surely he had. But never before had Isaiah observed God as he saw God on this occasion. It was a new vision of God. It was a vision of God in a sense in which he had never before seen him. And I have the feeling that for thousands of people, there's a new vision of God available if we would just be still long enough to see him. Look how he saw God this morning in these verses. He saw him first as an almighty, all-powerful, divine, sovereign God. I saw him high and lifted up, and his great train filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphims, each with their wings, but in great omniscience to him, God was eternal. Why would this aspect of God be more interesting to Isaiah? God was saying to him that morning, Isaiah, kings on earth will die, and thrones that are temporal will fall, and governments will change, and concepts of men will change. But my throne is eternal in the heavens. And when man fails, I'm here. My throne is eternal. I am a sovereign God. I am the ruler of the universe. I am your God. I am eternal. I love the concept of Jesus Christ as our elder brother moving alongside with us on the patterns of life and becoming available to us in all of life's circumstances. But sometimes I need to see God in all of his bigness and greatness and his eternal oneness. I need to know that overall, in the frustrated world in which I live, there is yet a superintending providence. There is a God that rules mankind, the God of history, God eternal, God on his throne. We were living in Africa when the news came, and it made headlines in that country. Well, one morning eating breakfast, we picked up the English newspaper in Johannesburg, and the headlines, God is dead, according to American theologian. And it startled us. What on earth are we going to do? Here we are out here 10,000 miles from home with a great group of missionaries, and we're trying to tell the people God's living, and God's available, and God's their answer. Now they've buried him over in America. What are we going to do? My concept was that maybe the theologian was wrong, because it did seem to me as though we had heard from God in our morning devotions, and so we just continued on. But I'm glad this morning God did not die. And I'm glad this morning, friend, he isn't dead this morning. God is on his throne. God is still eternal in his heavens. And God rules his world. You say, Brother Strickland, it seems to me this morning that the Lord has sort of turned our world loose. Oh, no. Oh, no. Behind it, behind the organization of this world this morning, there is a superintending providence. There's a hand that's mighty. I get some assurance out of it. Some of us went through, and then back in the earlier ministry, went through the experience of Hitlerism and the ideologies that came in those years. I don't know if you ever heard Hitler speak, perhaps many of you did, but in the early days in Germany, as he stood out and roared his challenge to the world, and thousands of German youth would stand at rigid attention for hours at the frenzied voice of this supposedly world leader. But he denounced God, he denounced religion. We know the past a little. Along the same time, Hirohito in Japan, Mussolini in Italy. I know there was fear over the world that these three men, defying God, oh, some of them became the mark of the beast. Some of them became the Antichrist. They became all kinds of symbols. But fear came over the church in some quarters. But thank God for those who still knew that God lived on his throne. I believe it was Dr. E. Stanley Jones, who is now deceased, who made the trip through that part of the world about that time and seemed to sum up all of our feelings in a very wonderful declaration of his faith in God. He said that Hirohito would be heard no more. The land of the rising sun would not hear his voice. He said Mussolini would die and Italy would move on. He said the hordes of Hitler would never conquer the world, and Hitler himself would pass from the scene of action. But he said the church and God and the message of the church would be eternal. And out of the ruins of Hitlerism, out of the ruins of Italy, out of the ruins of Hirohito's philosophy in Japan, would rise a new voice. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. It was that way, and it will be that way. God is in history. God is on his throne. He rules the world this morning. Oh, for a vision of an eternal, almighty God. How it would lift our hopes beyond the water gates, beyond the inquiries of our country, beyond the turbulence of these hours. The church will live on. God will live on. And thank God this morning, he's our Heavenly Father. To catch a new glimpse of him, a new vision of his strength and his power. And he has power to order his world as he pleases. Believing that gives us hope and courage in such an hour. But he saw God differently again, for he saw him as an eternal, absolutely holy God. The angels crying through the midst of the heavens, "Holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." And for once in his life, he saw absolute holiness in its completeness, in all of its purity, in all of its power. He was awestruck by it. For that vision produced within him something rather peculiar. One says to me, "Oh, Mr. Strickland, if I could just go to church and somehow through the choir singing or the special song or the sermon or through my meditative worship, if I could just catch such a glimpse of God, God so beautiful, so holy, so pure, oh, I think I'd just shout this morning all over the church." No, I don't believe you would. There's something about that vision that does something else to us. Isaiah cried and said, "Woe is me." But Isaiah, are you not encouraged with such a vision? Oh, there's something awesome about it. For Isaiah cried out and said, "Lord, I am a man of unclean lips, and I live in the midst of a people of unclean lips. I did not realize my impurity until I saw the purity of the King. And when I catch the vision of God's eternal holiness, I have to look at myself. And when I do, I see myself as I am in the light of His holiness. It's the most glorious, the most wonderful thing that ever happened. It does not necessarily bring happiness. It produces conviction. But this is the road that leads to happiness. For I cannot find my way toward God until I first have found my way through myself. It's that first step that sometimes in our lives becomes our stumbling block. But if I can see myself as I am in His light, then I can always find the measure of help that I need from Him. He saw Him as a holy God. He saw Him as an absolutely pure God. He saw Him as a God of the complete, a God of the absolute, not only in power, but in great purity and holiness. And He said, I can never be the same, for now mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. What a miserable experience it is to see ourselves, but what a refreshing experience to see beyond ourselves to the adequacy of God to help us. An old gentleman met me on the street some years ago in South Africa, and he said, aren't you the superintendent of this church out here? And I told him, yes. Well, he said, I've been wanting to see you and I haven't had the opportunity. He said, this isn't an appropriate place. But he said, I'd like to tell you that I never plan to return again to one of the churches. Oh, I said, Dad, what on earth? He said, the preacher over there insulted me. He said, I went out last Sunday night and he named the church and the preacher, one of the finest young men we had. But he said, he insulted me. He said, I went out and I felt real good because I went to church. But he said, that night he preached on sin. And he said, he looked right at me while he preached. And he said, it was though somebody had told him everything I had ever done. Or he just named everything I was doing. And how he knew me. And he said, it embarrassed me. It upset me. He said, in fact, when I went home, I found out I couldn't sleep. And he said, I finally called the doctor, and he had to come and give me a sleeping tablet. Now, he said, Mr. Strickland, I thought church was supposed to comfort you. But he said, he just insulted me. And I said, Dad, if you have just a moment, I don't think it was the preacher. I think you saw something else the other night. I think you saw yourself as he preached. And I think the Lord might have been talking to you. Dad, it is disturbing. It's terribly disturbing. But I've got news for you. If you go back, you'll find the remedy. About 2 months later, I went to that church. And as we came out of the vestry on Sunday morning, my old friend was sitting right down near the front. And I broke a rule of protocol. I slipped off the platform and went down and sat beside him a moment. And I said, you're still hanging around this church where they insult you. Oh, he said, preacher, I took you at your word. And I found the remedy. And he said, I have found peace. But he said, before I could find peace, I had to know myself and look at myself. And he said, it wasn't very pleasant. But he said, when I got through, the Lord helped me. Isaiah said, woe is me. I'm undone. I'm frustrated. I'm just Something's wrong with me. Mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And he saw a God also who was entirely adequate for his need. For in that vision, God sent an angel from heaven with a live coal from the altar of heaven. And that coal came, touched his lips. And the angel said, lo, this hath touched thy lips. Thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin is purged. And here the language is so clear and so beautiful. He was not forgiven of past transgressions, but something inwardly that caused the fear, something inwardly that caused the feeling of uncleanness, was taken out of his life, and he was purged and cleansed by the wonderful baptism which came to him from the altar of heaven. I have good news this morning. There's still an altar there. There are still angels ready to do the bidding of God. There is still a Holy Spirit in our world. When I come to the end of myself, I see God in all of his beauty and his joy and all of his wonderful power. I see him in all of his holiness. I can also find through him a grace that is adequate to take the sin from my life and cleanse and purge me until I can stand in his holy place with clean hands and a pure heart. I cannot do it alone. I cannot do it through my own maneuverings. I cannot do it through my own ritual. But there is today an adequate source of divine supply. We teach that, we believe that, thank God we have experienced that. But oh, how we long for our world today to come to feel and know that God is adequate for us in the now. Say, Brother Strickland, you read a historical thing this morning back in ancient history, but it isn't ancient history. What God can do for us now, he did then. What he did then, he can do now. And the adequacy is that for this generation, God can meet the need. And beloved, he can meet yours this morning if you'll just let him. I have a question and I'm through. Why did he not see this before? And then here's my text. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. The king died, then I saw. What happened? I was looking at the king. I was expecting the king. This is more than chronology, I believe. I believe it reveals the line of his vision. I was looking so horizontally at the king that it was not possible to lift up mine eyes unto the hills from whence really cometh my help. I'm going to let you finish my sermon this morning. But there are a lot of kings in a lot of people's lives. And those kings can become so big that they literally blot out a vision of God. This beautiful Kansas sun that we're enjoying, you can take a 50-cent piece and step outside the church and put it close enough to your eye that you can blot it out. It all depends on the proximity of that object to the human eye. I can take some stocks and bonds in New York. I can take some ranches, some houses, some land, some cattle, some automobiles, a little prestige. You just can name the list, and I'm going to let you finish it. I can have a job, a position. I can let anything come between my vision of myself and God. I can so become enamored with my family, myself, our own personal concerns. I can become interested in money. I can become interested in prestige. I can become interested in a thousand things until they blot out the vision. And my job is to keep God first. May I say this morning in closing? You have heard it said, and I am sure from this pulpit by our beloved pastor so many times, but God does have to be first. And everything else that we do and everything else that we are must become secondary. God is primary. His will is first. And to know and to do the will of God is the most important question that faces any of us here this morning. And I must have him first. I must put him first. He must be supreme. Anything else, God will not take the second place. And it's amazing sometimes how things get between us. I'm so glad to see Brother and Sister Smelsenbach this morning. They're two of the dearest friends my wife and I have ever had. He was born in Africa. He has given a lifetime in becoming one of the greatest missionaries our church has ever produced. He knows the man I'm talking about now because he lived out near him, and he was instrumental in helping this man become interested in the church, because the great mission station at Akron Hook, where Brother Smelsenbach spent so many years, was not far from the farm, Mr. Heldenhaes. I found him when I came out there, and I helped to lead him to Christ a time or two. He had a lot of up and down experiences. I don't think any of us really know who finally got him through, but I know Brother Smelsenbach was instrumental. All of us tried to help him. But I became very closely attached to him across some of the years. He had a beautiful farm. He was a scientific farmer. He had a large tract of African land, and it was very productive. And I remember, I don't know if Brother Smelsenbach remembers this incident, but I remember on a furlough when I came home, I went back out that way, and Brother Smelsenbach was the one that told me. He said, "Brother Charles, you better go out and see our old friend. He hasn't been coming to the services on the mission station lately." And I went out to visit him. He had one of the greatest harvest, just ready for harvest, that I had ever seen. He had a beautiful area of banana trees, and they were fully ripe. Out on beyond that, he had grown citrus, and it looked as though it were a grove in California or Florida, almost as far as you could see, those beautiful trees, loaded with the Valencia oranges, just about ready for harvest. They were the ones that he sent over to England and Europe for export. If you're ever in London and you buy an orange with an outspent stamp on it, it's probably his. I think you paid a shilling apiece for them over there. Then I went to his other field of corn. They call it mealies. And just as far as the eye could see, like some of these great fields of Kansas, beautiful. Oh, I'm not a farmer, but how it would thrill the heart of a farmer to see that. Tremendous harvest. He told me he was going to make 15,000 pounds sterling. That's about $45,000 on that cornfield. He said he'd make another 10 or 15,000 pounds sterling on his citrus. Greatest year he'd ever had, greatest harvest. But he said to me, "Dominie, or Reverend, I've been working on Sunday. Haven't been going to church." Now, if anyone's here from Dutch extraction, this is no, I love the Dutch people. I just love them. They do earn the title of being stubborn. I have a little of it in me, I guess, so I can confess it. But he wanted me to fuss at him a little, just fuss at him, just say, that's not right, that's not good. And that was what he wanted. But that afternoon, standing out there on his farm, I pulled back an arrow from a bow, and I shot it straight into his great heart. I got down on my knees with him and asked God not to let corn and citrus and bananas become his God. I touched a nerve. And you know, when you touch a nerve, he's a pretty big fellow. And in Africa, when you wound a lion, you don't stand around. I knew I had wounded my friend very deeply. I touched a raw nerve. I went back and got in the little pickup, and we drove home in silence. We went to dinner that evening, and I went out to the little rendezvous. I couldn't sleep, so I wrote a note to him. And way in the night, I pulled my little car out across the Transvaal and out heading for the Cape. The end of that day, on the short wave, I got the news of a storm that had passed through the eastern Transvaal. When I got the latitude and longitude, I looked it up on a weather map in the car, and sure enough, it had come through that section and through that farm. And I turned and went back, arrived there the next afternoon to a scene of destruction. The bananas were on the ground and covered in the mud. The great citrus trees were practically stripped of their fruit. And once it had touched the ground, it could never be exported. 15,000 pounds worth lying on the ground. The cornfield was utterly destroyed. And out near where we were a few days ago stood my great friend. Shoulders were stooped. He was whipped and defeated. You know, if you're friends, you don't have to talk a lot. I never said a word to him. I just slipped out and put my arms around him and stood there for a long time and wept with him. I felt those big shoulders shake. All that he'd worked for. Now, don't ask me if I thought God sent it. I don't know. I never told him that. I do not know till this day. I never try to answer for God. But I know something happened. He finally got on his knees in the mud. I can't really translate his prayer. But I'll never forget what he said. Oh, Meherahot, oh my God. Ek het ihais verlat, I've left your house. Hira diplas, this farm, et mekorin chavias, has become my king. Hira, ihetit no vechanium, you have taken it away. Bring truch na me to the vision von iself. Bring back the vision of yourself. And I saw a man reborn. I saw God merciful. I saw Mr. Heldenhaus reach back. That's when he asked you to build a little chapel out there on his farm. I went with him to the Africans that work on the farm, and he said, no more work on Sunday ever. And that's when he went to Brother Smelsenbach to build a little chapel. But when I saw the king, when the king died, I saw the Lord. Many of us in a hospital room have seen God because kings died. Many of us have looked up over broken dreams, and God became real because we couldn't see him before. May I suggest to you, beloved, he's been there all the time. We just didn't see him. But if I can just look beyond self and beyond wealth and beyond houses and beyond lands and beyond all the other things of life, I can see him there. And it's better to see him before I lose. I don't know that God will ever take them away from you. For some of us, he did. I don't think God's that cruel. He'll let you have them because you'll make your choice. But it's beautiful to see beyond them. And I'm glad this morning we can. I saw the Lord. And when you see him, he's high and lifted up. His throne fills the temple. And God is still adequate for all our needs. Oh, that the horizon could just lift from its horizontal to its vertical this morning for all of us. God bless you.